Welcome to Forward. I'm your host, Allison Innes. Today's episode comes from our vault, and it's one for fans of royalty. Fourth-year history student Gavin Watson found himself writing a paper on the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II when the Queen passed away suddenly in the fall of 2022. Gavin's research examines the controversial choice to televise the coronation ceremony and the impact it had on the public in Britain and across the Commonwealth. Gavin's paper was published in the History Department's undergraduate journal, The General, in the spring of 2023, and we recorded this episode with him at that time. Here's our conversation about royal coronations to mark the one-year anniversary of the coronation of King Charles III. Enjoy. And congratulations on finishing your fourth year of your history degree.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it's exciting.
But I understand you are on now into the Con Ed part, right?
Yes, yeah, Teachers College now, so it's a bit different, maybe a bit less history, unfortunately, but...
You'll always find some space for history.
Oh, yeah.
So I am really excited to hear about your project on the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II. Did I get the date right,
1953? 1953, yes, that's right.
Okay, phew. My credentials are intact. So I'd like to hear a little bit about how you got into that project, because you started researching this before Queen Elizabeth II died. And you just kind of wound up studying the right thing and coming out with a published essay at a very opportune time.
Yeah, it was very interesting, specifically that aspect of it. I think that sort of going through studying the monarchy in a very important time for the monarchy was something very unique and interesting. My interest in the monarchy and the royal family, I think, comes from, well, I study British history. That's just always what I've been interested in, and what part of British history is, I think, more interesting than the monarchy, really. I watched The Crown, another big entry point. I'm sure a lot of people familiar with The Crown will be familiar with some things that they saw in Charles's coronation, or even that I write about in my paper. And so I think really my academic interest in it gets down to what I talk about in my paper, one of the themes I talk about in my paper, which is the magic of monarchy and this sort of ineffable, why do we like them sort of thing, which seems very odd, but, you know, there's all this pomp and circumstance, and I sort of want to get to the bottom of all that.
Do you have an easy answer for that?
No. As ever in academia and history, there's never an easy answer, I don't think. So what I've done in this paper is sort of break it down into four themes, one of which is that magic. I think that you have this sort of ineffable appeal of the smoke and mirrors, of the mystery of the royal family and the monarchy in the modern day. And that's one of the themes that the BBC really mobilized in the 1953 coronation. So I should say that the 1953 coronation was the first one televised in British history. So that's really its big claim to fame, as well as crowning who we all grew up with as monarch. You know, not many people would still be around to remember George VI. Some, but not for long anyway. And so
his coronation had been filmed, but filmed for newsreels, right? Like it was a very curated.
Yes, exactly. And there's a big difference in that. It may seem small, but so in 1937, George VI's coronation allowed cameras to come in and create newsreels, and then they published them as these, you know, heavily edited with music over top and narrated, the sort of things that you see in
World
War
One.
Yes, black and white. Yeah, and so 1953, you have some color technology. Some of them, I believe, were still black and white. I'd say a majority. And you had it live, which was this much bigger deal, in that there was a fear of something going wrong. And that is an anxiety you see the establishment try and negotiate throughout this whole period, where they're trying to debate whether they're going to televise this or not, and they ultimately get overruled by public opinion.
So there were some notable voices that were very much against televising the coronation.
Yeah, so the main figures against televisation was the Duke of Norfolk, whose family has organized coronations since the first Duke of Norfolk, was the Archbishop of Canterbury, the modern Archbishop of Canterbury. You would have seen in Charles III's coronation, place the crown on his head. He's the sort of head of the Anglican faith, that the Church of England, just shy of the monarch themselves. And then you also had Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister at the time, who was initially very against televisation. He actually passed a ban in the House of Commons against televising the coronation that was then retracted the next week because of a massive public and press outcry, specifically against him. And then he repealed it. And it wasn't him that repealed it. It was the Queen that had acted in the public's mind, not really in reality, likely, to sort of be a queen to her people, that they sort of saw this ban as hiding the Queen from her people.
So this sounds vaguely familiar from, it's been a while since I've watched the Netflix series, but this sounds kind of familiar from the Netflix series, that she very much wanted it televised and the male powers that be weren't so keen on it.
So the crown actually depicts Prince Philip as the biggest and most ardent proponent for televisation, and that's not really the case. Who we see as the biggest proponent of televisation is the BBC, and executives in the BBC. They really had nothing to lose and all to gain from the coronation being televised. They were Britain's only network on television up until a few years after the coronation, when ITV was created. But yes, the BBC had a long history with the royal family. They created the Christmas address that you see on television every year.
And that was initially a radio.
Yes.
A radio address. Yep.
Yeah, and actually, Elizabeth the Second, before she was crowned, denied putting it on television. The year before she was crowned, still only on radio, these sort of fears around television. Television was also sort of considered a very lowbrow medium back then. So you had this idea of sort of television in the household and it being a very domestic thing, not something for something as grand as monarchy in the public sphere. You also had a lot of associations with housewives and watching soap operas and commercials for household products. And so you can read a bit of, you can take a feminist reading into how television was sort of seen as a bit lowbrow because of that.
So in addition to this idea that it is kind of a lowbrow medium, what were some of the concerns that Churchill and the Duke of Norfolk and the Archbishop, what were some of the concerns they had around the idea of televising this? Why were they so resistant? Or what were the reasons they gave for being so resistant?
Yeah, so there was sort of one prevailing reason that they were afraid of the Queen herself faltering in some way. They were afraid of close-ups specifically because they saw it as sort of breaking that wall between monarch and and person almost. They didn't really want Elizabeth to be seen as a person, which seems kind of cruel, but really she in that moment, and like Charles was in the coronation, isn't really supposed to be Charles. It's supposed to be King Charles. It's supposed to be almost the king, never mind the Charles, is the queen.
Okay.
And so that's why you saw Charles as well being so stoic. There was almost no emotion on his face, very contrasted with Camilla, which some people criticized her for.
I was just going to say, I did not watch the coronation. I know you did, and we're going to get to talking a little bit more about that. But I certainly saw on social media and whatnot criticisms of both of them. Criticisms of him for being too stoic, and criticism of Camilla for being much too happy.
Yes.
And pleased with it. And so that's kind of an interesting contrast there, I think.
Yes, definitely. And that's something we can talk about too, is how social media has sort of affected the coronation in this way that it wouldn't have in 1953, where you see a much more open and apparent criticism of what's going on. And it's important to note that there was criticisms of the 1953 coronation, and historians and sociologists in the past have sort of brushed over that a little bit.
Let's get into that a little bit, because yeah. I found that interesting in your research. So here we can talk a little bit too here about some of the sources you use, because this was also very interesting to me. And for our listeners, we'll have a link to the full paper that was just published in the undergraduate journal, The General, so that they can read the full thing and see the various images as well that you've included with that. But you look at some newspaper coverage, but you also are using the mass observation project or database. I'm not quite sure. I can't quite remember what you called
it.
Which is in and of itself a very interesting primary source.
Yeah, absolutely. So the mass observation archives are from the University of Sussex, and basically it was this project in the interwar period up until the post-war period, World War II, that is, to sort of get a sense of the British public. It was sort of in this era where they were sort of trying to figure out what it meant to be British. I mean, they're still trying to figure out what it means to be British. This idea that you could ask a question of a common Briton, and they could lodge a response, or they could lodge a response of their free will, something that piqued their interest. And so the questions fielded out completely voluntary. So this isn't a sort of census thing. It is by the volition of the people doing it. So it's a great tool to use, especially because it was undertaken during the wartime. So you have people giving accounts of the Blitz, to something as simple as what they thought about jazz music. And there was very controversial opinions on jazz music. it's greatly helpful for something like this, which is gauging reaction to this big event. It's important to note, though, that it's not really all of Britons. It's a very select sort of middle class of Britons. You know, the working class Briton isn't going to have enough want or need to try and fill out what they thought of jazz music. They're working for a wage. Likewise, a middle class person that might not be interested might not fill it out, and so it has problems. But it is very useful in getting individual opinions on things.
So it self-selects, I suppose you could say, like people who have strong opinions who will want to respond to the question, and people who don't really care might not.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So what were the criticisms that you found in the sources that you were looking at?
So a lot of them had to do, so most of this, of the criticisms and the analysis done on that, I got from an article by Orna Bring, who's a historian and sociologist who looked into that sort of aspect of things, and especially in newspapers. What he was asking was sort of, are these concerns being reflected by the press at the time? And the short and long of it was that they weren't. There was concerns by the British public that weren't covered in press coverage. And those were, he mainly sorted into two categories, which were national and economic. So economic is pretty self-explanatory, and you see some controversy around that in this coronation, in that in both instances, there is this great lavish ceremony in a time of economic recession, a bad time for the economy, both right after the war. The British economy was being bailed out by the Americans at the time. And now, which is, I mean, in dire straits of its own, coming out of Brexit and stuff.
And it's a ceremony that is paid for by the taxpayers, like by the government, not by the royal family, correct?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. There is the royal household. I think they get paid an allowance, essentially, by the government, that I forget what it's called, but... yes, it is paid for by the government, and also the economic costs of the bank holiday on that day and all that sort of stuff. I'm sure somebody has compiled it into millions of pounds of lost money. You can debate whether it's lost or not, because it does all this work to shore up national unity, which is another theme of the paper, and does all these things, which actually leads into the other criticism.
I was just going to say, so the economics criticism, that's kind of one category, and this national criticism or nation criticism.
Yeah. So the big thing in 1953 was that the idea of this coronation was sort of the first, well, was the first coronation in a post-war Britain. And post-war Britain, you had a lot of, really, the British Empire was crumbling at this point. India had left the jewel of the crown of the British Empire. And thus Elizabeth was the first monarch that wasn't crowned as Empress of India or Emperor of India since Victoria. And so it's this odd sort of time of anxiety, moral anxieties, you know, these like Chas and these things coming out of World War II, a fear of the conservatism slipping away. You also had fears of the empire crumbling. And so what the coronation really tried to do, and what I argue that the BBC specifically tried to do in broadcasting the coronation, was shore up all these things, was reify these conservative values, and say to Britain and the empire, sort of, we are united, we're a commonwealth now, and we're still a united kingdom. But what you saw in 1953 was not that, and what you see now is in many ways not that.
It's a very interesting time for the United Kingdom itself, with issues around Northern Ireland coming to the front again and Scottish independence, but then also the Commonwealth, because we've seen in recent years a move by some of the Commonwealth nations to move away from having the Queen as their head of state, or now the King, as their head of state.
Yes, and actually I believe a Caribbean island recently, just after the coronation, had decided that they're still going to pursue getting rid of the King as head of state, and it's happened recently with other countries. And I mean, you can't really fault them. this sort of old imperial system that really doesn't benefit them in any way is why they're leaving, right? And these old ancient pomp and circumstance and smoke and mirrors and the ceremonies trying to keep that alive.
So coming back to that idea of the pomp and circumstance and that magic, again, which is an idea you get more into in your essay, one of the concerns, as I understand it, is that people wouldn't be sufficiently reverent if they were watching this event on TV. But I also get a sense from your paper that the fact that people were watching it on TV actually worked in benefit of the monarchy, or certainly in terms of some of those unity goals.
Yes, absolutely. And that's a big sort of discrepancy in what the fears were and what, at least what I argued, the result to be in that, you know, a big fear of Churchill in particular. He said that he didn't want this to be anything like a theatrical production. This can't be theater. This has to be reverent and spiritual. In my mind, this is the most stunning example of theater, coronation and royal ritual. But that was their fear, was that it would be treated as a theatrical production and not as a reverent ceremony, which is a bit of a different question.
And you have a nice quote about this idea of people sitting around the TV with their dinner on their lap. But in reality, a lot of people gathered together in groups, and there was that sense, or those who responded to the mass observation, there was a sense of unity and belonging.
You have really this mediated intimacy is what, I was going to say what I called it, but I, as academics do, took that from somebody else, Laura Clancy, who's a historian who worked with the coronation and mediated intimacy. And that's the sort of the idea of the television as this intimate thing. Like I was saying before, the television's place is in the home, right? Which was their concern, the establishment's concern, that it's this sort of informal, lowbrow sort of method to portray majesty. But really, the effect of that is that this majesty, this family, this queen is coming into your home, essentially. And that does a lot for emotional connection between the monarchy. So, you know, I quote through mass observation in my paper, these people who saw it and were commenting throughout and sort of, you know, it might have been seen as irreverent by the Archbishop of Canterbury, the things that they were saying, but it still sort of did work to cement the Queen and the royal family in the lives of everyday Britons. You know, people commenting on the fact that Philip kissed the Queen as he pledged loyalty, which William did to Charles in this coronation, which was sort of that shows that sort of continuity that the royal family likes so much.
And part of that continuity as well, you talk one of the four themes you talk about is this idea of presenting Elizabeth II as a mother. And there seems to be this tension between being afraid to show her as a person, you know, in case she somehow falters, but then also using her femininity to present her kind of as a mother figure. And can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I thought that was really interesting, and especially around that classic picture that resonates so much of a very bored Charles as a young child, and then some of the pictures we saw of the young Prince Louis as well, looking very bored during the coronation.
Yes, that kind of love that continuity, that sort of mirrored image. That part is very interesting. the BBC and the government sort of saw, I mean, it was a big deal that Elizabeth was a queen. They didn't have a queen since Queen Victoria. And it was an Elizabeth at that, you know, Queen Victoria and Queen Elizabeth I are both very revered monarchs in British history. They did a lot under their reigns, or a lot happened under their reigns. And so Churchill has this very famous address around the coronation where he invokes, you know, the feeling of God save the Queen rather than God save the King. He was glad to say that hymn again. And so you saw this sort of focus on the fact that she was a queen in this coronation. I can't find the quote here, but an American paper basically said that the glamour wouldn't be nearly so appealing of the coronation if this was a king. And so you have that feminized glamour that...
And young, right?
Yes, young. 20s. And you see sort of a difference in the oldest king ever coronated this year. He's 74. And she was in her early 20s. And so you have, she's also a mother. And so you have that being invoked by the coronation. The cameras switched to Prince Charles just after the crowning, you know, this very important moment of the coronation, and immediately switches to Prince Charles, who was 4 at the time, up on the balcony with the Queen Mother. And
Princess Anne was also a child, but she wasn't at the coronation.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, she was deemed a bit too young to risk attending.
Because, of course, you don't want the children misbehaving on television at such an important moment.
Yeah, I'm sure that was
unpredictable at the best.
I'm sure that was a worry for Princess Kate at this coronation. So you have a lot of work done by the BBC to present the Queen as a mother, and that invokes themes of Elizabeth I, who famously said that she was married to the nation. She didn't ever have a husband. Mm-hmm. Now Elizabeth had a husband, but they almost present her as this mother to the nation, that she's a great mother to Charles and Anne, and thus she'll be a great mother to Britain.
And in what you've seen of the recent coronation, have we seen any of that gendered relationship? Because I kind of have a feeling that from the coverage that I've seen, certainly, that presenting Charles as father to the nation, given the current state of family relationships, very public disruptions in family relationships, might not go over too well. Did you see any particularly gendered messages around Charles or Camilla?
Yes, I think that the gendered aspect is obviously notably less than in the 1953 coronation. I think you could definitely argue that the three other themes that I talk about held a bit more relevance in this one. But I mean, gender, I wrote this paper with Dr. Jessica Clark, who you had on a couple weeks ago. And I recently took a course called Gender and Empire with her, and we sort of learned through that course that, I mean, there's really nothing you can't apply gender to, if you really look at it. And so you can always see genders in these places. But I think noting what you said, that it is really hard to portray Charles as this loving, you know, caring father to the nation when, you know, his history, I'll put it at that, and the fact that the history was so public and that we know it, and if you didn't live through it, you're watching The Crown, likely, and so you're seeing all these things that you might not have known before and are sort of gasping in abject horror, maybe, about this man who's been crowned king.
Yes, and certainly the relationship between media and the royal family has been a very fraught one, particularly those of us who might remember the 90s, the royal family in the 90s, where just everything that could go wrong seemed to go wrong in terms of family conflicts and relationships and that kind of thing. So one of the things that has changed a lot, perhaps in some ways, has been perceptions of multiculturalism between Britain in the 1950s and Britain today. And you mentioned about the crowning by the Archbishop of Canterbury, who is the head of the church of the Christian Church in England. I'm curious, kind of on that religious aspect and that aspect of this as a religious ritual, and kind of what were some of the concerns that they had around Elizabeth with kind of keeping that sufficiently holy and reverent.
Yes, so a big thing that I talk about in the paper is the fact that there was the anointing and the communion in the ceremony. They were sort of held in regard as the most holy parts of the ceremony. And that's effectively the compromise that they came to televise the coronation, that the Archbishop and the Duke of Norfolk both insisted that these two things not be shown, not be televised. And so what you see in 1953 is the camera cuts to the organ, or cuts to a tapestry, the ceremony goes on. And in 1953, you can hear everything said during the anointment and the oaths given. Interestingly, you can't in this one. They're singing over it. But that was a big concern back then, and it evidently still is now, because in Charles III's coronation, you had screens go up all around him that protected sort of him throughout the anointing. And then during the communion, you can actually see him during the communion, but it's a very, very wide shot of the whole abbey. There is still that distance between the sort of monarch and the viewer in that way.
And you mentioned as well that, so for Queen Elizabeth, they had like a canopy that was held over top of her, right? And then for King Charles, they had like tapestry walls, kind of around three sides and then space for the Archbishop. But you mentioned to me when we've talked before about some of the symbolism that the tapestries showed.
Yes, absolutely. It's interesting to note that in Elizabeth II's coronation, it was, like you said, basically a canopy, like a golden tent, basically. And it had been, to my understanding anyway, that way for quite a while. And so you have these screens go up now, which is in a way even more divisive. You know, it's almost a literal wall between the king and anybody watching the anointing. And so, you know, it's interesting to see that as the most, almost the most blocked off that anointing has ever been. The actual screen on it was very interesting in what it's trying to depict. I could talk about hours and hours and hours, I'm sure, about every single symbol and metaphor and whatever else throughout the whole ceremony, because every single thing is steeped in that. But this screen basically had a large tree on it, and each of the leaves was embroidered with the name of a Commonwealth nation. Mm-hmm. So this idea of the family tree, almost, of the empire, the Commonwealth, with the royal cipher at the bottom to sort of show that the king's a servant to all of these places.
That's interesting that they switched from a canopy to something that was that's more kind of walling off. Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, do you think that was a response to televising it and trying to find that compromise between keeping it sacred?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I think that it's interesting to note. I'm not really sure what it means.
It's a project, I guess.
yeah, because it is interesting that there was this very prevalent anxiety in the planning. And I'm sure more will come out of the planning later as history gets revealed. It is definitely interesting. Yeah.
So with this idea of televising, so as we mentioned before with Queen Elizabeth's the coronation, it was like the BBC and they were the only ones broadcasting it. And you talk in your paper about the building of television relay towers so that it could be viewed on the European continent. You talk about how RAF jets were scrambled to fly the footage to Canada so that Canadians could watch it the same day. And now we've moved into this time where we've got unprecedented access to media, and people like yourself could get up in our case in our time zone here, I think it was something like 5 a.m. yes. And watch the coronation live while it was happening. And so along with that access, you also get the generation of memes on social media, which I confess is largely how I consumed it. I did look at the BBC website, but I did not get up to watch the whole thing. But there have been a lot of memes without even really trying to find them on social media. They're very much there. And then I was also thinking as well that you also have very high definition television. I saw somebody commenting on how you could see the graffiti on the chair that's used at like the actual throne that is used in the ceremony. So I'm kind of curious about your thoughts kind of on that shift from that one still alive but still controlled to this much much harder to control production.
Yes. Well, that's a very interesting question, because you know, the legacy of the 1953 coronation is that it was this huge success, you know, a great triumph of national unity, of empire, of Britain. You know, Britain still has it. Only Britain can do this, which you saw a lot of in the lead up to this coronation. But really, that's not necessarily true in all cases. That the coronation almost worked as a sort of, you know, to plaster over the cracks of crumbling empire, of a society that was going through a lot of turbulation, and the turbulation continued after, you know, just this temporary reprieve. But in the press coverage after, it similarly reflected that sort of great triumph. With some exceptions, there was two articles total published in the British Isles by mainstream papers that critiqued the coronation in any way following. One was The Guardian, and they put out a cartoon published by a man named Lowe. I don't have the first name, but it basically depicted the picture is in my paper, but it basically depicted you know, the aftermath of this big party, and it said £1 million spree on a price tag next to it, and it received huge backlash from the readership of The Guardian. And The Guardian is a liberal-leaning paper in Britain, and still was back then. And, you know, people said, how dare you do this so close after the coronation? And then the other one was in Scotland, critiquing the coronation. And that was it, really. I mean, there was no social media. You know, people could talk about what they thought to each other. But then you have today, Right. Where, like you said, I mean, maybe my social media is a bit biased because I like British history, but yes, I open Instagram and TikTok and whatever and see 10,000 things about the coronation. And a lot of them are from people, you know, who aren't historians. They're not, you know, they're not incredibly interested in British history or royal ritual or anything. And they're lodging their opinions, which is great. And you see a lot of jokes and memes, like you said, about the coronation. That sort
very
of
irreverent.
Yes. I'm sure the
much more irreverent than eating lunch on your lap while you're watching the coronation, or breakfast on your lap, I guess.
Yes, I would dare say so. I'm sure some are even inappropriate to mention in the setting. But yes, absolutely. And you see that sort of public response is much more, you know, accessible and can be plainly seen. And, you know, in this modern age where the monarchy is really becoming less and less popular generally throughout the world, most certainly. And so, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this coronation is remembered. It's obviously a bit too soon to make that call, even decades after some of the papers that I used in mine, you know, said in 1980s that it was too soon after the coronation to really write a history about it.
That's really interesting that it's something that historians shied away from while the Queen was alive, and hope, and maybe now it's something now that she has died and the monarchy's moved on and maybe this is something that would receive a little bit more attention in the future. I'll await for your paper on King Charles' coronation. But I just want to come back to the BBC again, because the BBC is really the central, I mean, there's the Queen and the BBC that kind of feature largely in this story. We had been talking about some of the concerns that the various people involved had about televising it. What was the how did the BBC argue, obviously successful, for televising this, and kind of what was the outcome for them in this process?
Yeah, so as I said before, the coronation was very well received, right? It was received as a triumph. And notably, that triumph was not only for the royal family, it was for the BBC. One of the newspaper article headlines following the coronation was Queen's Day, TV's Day. And so it not only did work for the BBC in that way, but it really changed television as a medium. In Britain, you know, it was previously this sort of lowbrow thing, as we've been talking about, but then it sort of changed in large part due to the coronation. And, you know, all of a sudden, every royal event was on television. They realized that, oh, this is working. We should do more of this. And you know, they sort of leaned into that intimacy between the British people and the royal family.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting aspects of your paper as well, I thought, was your use of sociology in the analysis. So you're working with some historical sources that we've already talked about, but you're also drawing on some sociological theories and thinking, right?
Yeah. So that was of great interest to me, writing this paper, because and that was partially born out of necessity. So like you were saying before, the Queen hasn't really been written about in history, and I believe she now will be upon her death. But there was this sort of, you know, unspoken rule that the Queen just wasn't really historicized. She was still alive. You know, the events that she lived beside have long since been historicized. Like the Suez Canal crisis and all of these scandals that happened early in her reign, even in the 80s, you know, like the British invasion, all this stuff was historicized alongside her, but she hasn't been thought of in that way, at least up until now. And so there wasn't a lot of historical writing on the coronation and what that really meant. And so I had to get a lot of my work from sociologists. And so at least three of the main four themes that I dealt with, the sort of magic, the social unity, and mediated intimacy, all come from sociology or social historians. And so there is this idea of a sort of, you know, what did this coronation do for British society going forward? And there's tons of different angles you can take on any sort of history. But I'm learning that I really like the social aspect of things and that sort of sociological take to it.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. That was the aspect of history that always interested me the most as well. Kind of what things mean for the people who are living through them, and sometimes quite ordinary people, as much as we're able to get at those opinions. I'm sure whoever decides to research King Charles at some point, provided they still have technology to access all of the memes and whatnot that have been made, I think we'll have a plethora of content to look at as well.
Yes, I'm sure as well, because I mean, one of the sociological papers I used was published months, like a matter of months after the 1953 coronation. And you see me sort of drag it throughout the paper, because, you know, I mean, as a historian, you know, we're used to studying things so long after they've happened. And I think that's really for a reason, because you're in a way sort of divorced from it. You can look at it within the context. And that's a big thing. One of the scholars that I use, David Cannadine, who wrote about the coronation, said that, you know, you can't really look at these sort of things without context, because then it's just, you know, it's just the event, and really, you know, there's not much to gain from that without what does the event mean, and what does it mean in the context of past events, which all sounds very vague, but is still very interesting to me.
So that kind of leads me into my next question, which is a little change of direction. So with the podcast, I like to ask people about their experiences. You're our first regular interview with an undergraduate student. I understand you did this paper as part of a directed reading course with Dr. Jessica. And I was wondering if you could maybe just kind of explain what a directed reading course is and kind of how that worked and what that experience was like for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first, I'd like to thank Dr. Clark, because, you know, it was a great honor and privilege working with her and working on this paper together. Because, it was a great help. In that sort of directed research or directed reading course, it is you and the professor individually writing about something that interests you and also falls under the expertise of the professor. So the year before, in the winter term of the year before, I had sort of approached Dr. Clark about being in this course. It was very rushed because I was very close to the deadline.
that often happens.
Yes. But I sort of came up with these very wildly different sort of topics and came to the conclusion of something about the media and the royal family. And we didn't really flesh it out back then. It was going to be this huge survey thing, I think, as all papers start out as, and then it narrows down and narrows down and narrows down. But that is why I chose this and started working on this before the Queen died. So I wrote this in the fall term of this past year. But had chosen this topic the year before, right? So it was very interesting developing, you know, how we're looking at this in the context of that. And it was also a great added bonus to be in private meetings with a British historian while all this stuff was going on. You know, it got a lot of unique insights on things, and it was very nice having those discussions.
Yes, I imagine that you must have had some really fascinating conversations. So the other question I wanted to ask you about, I mentioned that this paper had been published in the journal, in the General, which is the undergraduate history journal. And I'll put a link in the show notes. But for those who aren't familiar, it's a peer-reviewed journal that is produced to undergraduate, generally fourth-year undergraduate history students, co-edit it, and they solicit history papers from Brock students, and those papers go through a selection process and a peer review process, and then eventually they are published open access online, but also print copies for the contributors. And it was at the launch of this year's General that I heard about your project. So again, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit from your perspective, getting that really kind of rare insight into how academic publishing works while you're still in your undergrad, and kind of what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a great experience by all accounts. I thank the editors in chief for ultimately choosing my paper. You know, I wouldn't be talking with you right now if they didn't. And so, yeah, it was a great experience. They sort of, you know, I found out that they were soliciting papers through social media, and decided to submit this one because this is probably the paper I'm most proud of in my undergraduate career, and I had just finished working on it. And so there was a peer review process, so peers reviewed it, you know, it's pretty self-explanatory.
Fellow student, yeah.
Yes, fellow student. I learned some new things about Chicago citation style.
There is always something new to learn about citations.
Yes, and it was a great experience just from beginning to end, being honored and published is... Yeah, there's nothing more I can say that it was very cool, very nice.
Well, thank you so much for your time today and for sharing this with us. And I really encourage our listeners to check out your paper and read it. It's very interesting. I learned a lot from reading it. It's really well written. So you should definitely be proud of it. Yes, and thank you for joining us. And whenever you get around to writing more, I hope at some point in your future you have an opportunity to do more research on this if you want, of course. But I'd love to read your analysis someday on this.
Yes. Absolutely, maybe when I'm
I'm still around.
And I'm writing in an armchair and about King Charles III and his legacy. Yeah.
But congratulations on a very well written piece, and the entire journal is really well done with a lot of excellent pieces. So I do encourage our readers to check out all of our student authors, and it's a great example as well of the kinds of work that students in history and classics and that kind of thing, the kinds of research that you get to do in the exciting project. So thank you so much for sharing that with us today.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. I hope that people can learn about the coronation, maybe rewatch it after they listen to my paper or will read my paper.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Forward. Find our footnotes, links to more information, transcripts, and past episodes on our website, brocku.ca/humanities. We love to hear from our listeners, so join us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Brock Humanities. Please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting app so you don't miss an episode. Forward is hosted and produced by Allison Innes for the Faculty of Humanities at Brock University. Sound editing is by Serena Atella, and theme music is by Khaled Imam. This podcast is financially supported by the Faculty of Humanities at Brock University.